This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about medical ethics, and with me to talk about it is Susan Lederer, chair of the Medical History and Bioethics Department at the University of Wisconsin. Her most recent book is called Flesh and Blood, and she was also a contributor to the tome, Human Radiation Experiments. Sue, tell me how you got interested in the field of medical ethics and the history of medical ethics.
Well, I'll start a little bit earlier and say I started off being a pre-med. I was interested in medicine and then quickly realized I was more interested in sort of what physicians did and how patients experienced health care than in actually doing it. And so where I was an undergraduate, there was one of the few programs that had a history of medicine program.
Where and was that?
That was at Johns Hopkins. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this was actually sort of, you know, in the decade when bioethics was being born or was sort of taking shape. And when I came to the University of Wisconsin as a graduate student, I was interested in somehow combining a lot of the ethical questions with my interest in history of medicine. So actually my dissertation was looking historically at the use of human subjects in research and why it turns out that the people who were most concerned about using orphans as guinea pigs were the people who were most concerned with protecting dogs and cats from medical researchers. And why, for example, even though we had people trying to protect orphans, you know, in 1900, the actual protections for orphans from research did not really occur until the 1970s.
How much experimentation was going on with orphans?
Oh, there was a great deal of experimentation with orphans because they were readily available. And in the infamous words of one researcher, they were cheaper than keeping animals because they were already being fed at state expense.
I don't know anything about this orphan experimentation history.
Well, they did. Well, for example, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, this is the heyday of the germ theory of disease. So in order to conform to Koch's postulates, you need to isolate the germ, grow it in pure culture, and then inject it into an animal or person to prove that it's the germ that causes the disease. So orphans, for example, were injected with the germs that cause gonorrhea. They attempted to inject orphans with syphilis, with the germs that cause whooping cough, tuberculosis, so on. This is also the heyday of the deficiency disease concept. So, for example, orphans at the Hebrew Orphan Home in New York City, infants were being fed, and they withheld orange juice until they developed, you know, scurvy, and then they would give them orange juice, and then they could therefore establish that there was something in orange juice that prevented that disease from occurring.
So there's continuity between that and the notorious Muskegee experiments.
I'd say the same kind of desire to find out, you know, what causes disease and what is the natural progression of disease, that it's not dissimilar.
And then in human radiation experiments, you talked about some of the people during the Cold War who were experimented on. And these experiments were run by the Pentagon, the CIA. Who was running them?
Well, they were funded largely by the Department of Defense. They tended not to run them as much, but they gave money, and they engaged physicians at a variety of institutions across the country and in Canada to test isotopes, to expose people to various levels of radiation and so forth.
What kind of informed consent was there?
Was there informed consent? Did that exist? Actually, the earliest use that we found of the words informed consent occurs in a document that was issued by the Atomic Energy Commission in terms of their isotope program, in which they mentioned getting informed consent from individuals who are going to receive these isotopes as part of, you know, experimental studies, say, metabolism, or, you know, the role of iron in metabolism or something. but informed consent was more honored in the breach than in the observance.
Well, it's a tricky concept anyway. I mean, there's consent, and then how informed is informed consent?
Right. Well, but for example, one of the most notorious experiments we looked at were the plutonium injections. The people, for example, at UCSF, the University of California, San Francisco Medical School, claimed that they were administering informed consent, but the word plutonium was classified. So it's hard to imagine the universe in which there could be informed consent.
No, that doesn't sound very informed to me. Were some of the humans who were experimented on killed as a result of the experiments?
You know, the question of the physical harm suffered by individuals in the human radiation experiments is a difficult one. Certainly, I mean, and because it involves a broad variety of experiments involving ionizing radiation. For example, releasing radioactive iodine-131 from a processing plant. And then 20 years, 30 years down the road, people develop thyroid cancer and they die. Now, whether that's a direct response to that release of iodine-131, people have challenged. I think it's probably true that in the bulk of the experiments with radioactive isotopes, people did not suffer direct physical harm. And one of the concepts that we worked with a great deal in the context of this was dignitary harm, because it's, you know, I'd argue it's wrong to use people as objects without informing them. And it's particularly hard to understand because I think so many people would have volunteered, you know, to be experimental subjects because they were caught up in the politics of the Cold War themselves.
So how did they grab people for these if people didn't volunteer?
Well, if you had the misfortune to fall, you know, to become injured, say, in an accident and go to a hospital in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, that's how the first person, he was an African-American truck driver, was in a bad car accident. He was a plutonium injection.
Was the fact that he was African-American germane?
You know, I don't know. It's hard to say. Certainly there were a number of African-Americans who were involved as subjects in human radiation experiments, but whether they were signaled or, you know, explicitly identified as a research pool, I don't think so. You know, and you could argue that, you know, when we're looking at, say, downwinders and the effects of the release of radioactive iodine, you know, if you had the misfortune to live in a sparsely populated part of the country, you know, that was your misfortune.
Mm-hmm. Terry Tempest Williams writes a lot about that, the essayist and environmentalist who's lost family members to cancer because they were downwinders.
Right. And it's not just the people that you would immediately expect, but for example, the upper tier of Iowa has a very high concentration of cancers associated with fallout and the release, the deliberate releases of things like radioactive iodine because of the prevailing sort of wind patterns over the country.
Let's talk a little bit about flesh and blood. Why did you focus on transfusions, the blood, and flesh, which is organ donations. Why did you limit your focus so narrowly there? It's an interesting book.
Oh, thank you. Well, the way I got interested in blood transfusion was through the work that I did on the history of human experimentation. I was very interested in the emergence of professional guinea pigs, that is, people who received payment and actually sort of had a career being a research subject. And I was very interested that there was a time, for example, in which there was considerable overlap between people who were paid to be research subjects and people who were professional blood donors. Oftentimes they were medical students who were readily available, who needed money, who could be tapped in both senses of the word for their participation. I was also so struck by the fact that blood transfusion in the first part of the 20th century is very different than blood transfusion today in that it had to be accomplished surgically. That is, it involved sort of cut down exposure of a vein or artery and literally being sewn to the blood vessel of another recipient. It's no surprise to me that it was difficult to get donors under those circumstances. And I guess I still find it so extraordinary that this was undertaken, especially because blood transfusion was first performed when, you know, someone was either on the brink of death or actually had already, you know, had already died. And so the emotional demands of being a donor, to be literally sewn to the body of a, you know, someone that you loved who was in extremis, was really extraordinary to me. And it turns out, because of, that it was surgeons, it was also surgeons who were performing blood transfusions, but also the surgeons who were performing the earliest sort of transplants. So that's why I joined them together. Most people don't think of transfusion and transplantation together. But for me, in surgeons like Alexei Carrel and many others, they're doing the same kinds of work, which then ultimately diverges.
And I imagine there was a longstanding objection, religious objection, to doing any of this.
Well, I mean, it depends. I mean, I think there are, you know, there's a great variety of not only religious experience, but, you know, religious responses. Some churches were more welcoming of these developments. Others took more seriously, you know, the literalness of sort of the resurrection of the body, you know, and bodily integrity and sort of what it was going to be like to be physically resurrected, sort of, you know, in the second coming. And therefore, sort of the idea that you would show up with someone else's kidney or someone else's leg or arm or whatever body part it is was disturbing to them.
And one of the themes in this book, Flesh and Blood, Susan Leder, is the idea that what was permissible or what was deemed impermissible at the beginning now seems commonplace. Certainly blood transfusions seem fairly commonplace in the 21st century, but there were controversies back then, especially at the primitive stage where you described actual patching people together. And then we almost at every step along the way with organ transplants, there have been similar controversies. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, I think there are a couple things. One of the things that was so striking to me, and one of the ways I think that I differ from some of the contemporary bioethicists, is what people were willing to do in order to, you know, restore life or appearance or bodily function. I'm more struck by what the lengths people are willing to go to than by the restrictions that they're willing to put on the practice. In the book, I mean, I describe, for example, people who are, you know, literally sewn to the body of a dog or a live sheep. They're going to be in bed with someone, you know, for 10 or 11 days to have an ear transplant, which I think is really remarkable. And what I was struck by is how little, I mean, people take this kind of, I mean, treat this more as a joke than as a serious ethical problem. One of my favorite stories is this ear transplant that involved, I mean, you know, it appears on the front page of the New York Times in 1903, $5,000 would be paid for an ear. And 150 people show up and are willing to do this. It involves sort of partially, you know, taking off part of the ear and sewing it to the body of the recipient in bed for 10 days. And the only medical ethical discussion I saw of this was the complaint that it was going to be an unrelated man and woman in the same bed at one point, because they said it could be a male or female ear as long as it was a right ear and of the right shape and size, which I thought was really extraordinary.
What are the ethics of selling body parts?
That's a complicated question. And one of the things that I'm struck by is that there has always been a market for body parts. I mean, it goes back to the earliest days of skin grafting or of blood transfusion. And there are people who are professionals. At the same time, there has coexisted sort of, you know, kind of the pure gift or altruistic act of either giving blood or giving, giving a part of yourself, literally. And I think what was interesting to me is that in this country, you know, in the 1980s, was the passage of the National Organ Transplant Act, was an absolute prohibition on the sale of body parts and of whole blood. But, you know, that's all another sort of interesting sort of exception, the fact that you can sell red blood cells, but you can't sell whole blood.
But
you
what
can
does
sell
that mean?
Plasma, you know.
But people get paid for donating blood still.
Well, they don't get paid for their whole blood. They get paid for their plasma, or they get paid for their cells.
But that's a distinction that's lost on most people who are donating. They want the money.
Well, they're very careful about following the letter of the law, if not the spirit. But as you are perhaps aware, one of the ongoing tensions about our organ transplant programs in this country is that there are not enough organs. And there have been a variety of suggestions about financial incentives. And I think it's actually we're getting closer and closer to greater and greater financial incentives for, say, someone who's, for access to the bodies of the dead and of the living. I would not be surprised if we move in that direction.
And that wouldn't trouble you?
Well, I mean, it troubles me that the poor are most likely to be exploited by this. However, I mean, on the other hand, you know, one could certainly make the argument that, you know, people are selling their organs now, but and they're doing so under conditions that are abysmal. A lot of money is being made, but
this
it's
is
not
black
going
market.
To yes, it's not going to the suppliers of organs. And that certainly seems wrong to me.
And then there's the utilitarian argument that, you know, there are 50,000 people a year or more who are waiting for an organ and can't get one.
That's true. That's true. And certainly, you know, I have, you know, made the argument to students, well, we could just take somebody off the street, you know, we could distribute all their organs. You know, the utilitarian benefit would be great to all the recipients. You know, there'd be the loss of that one person.
Yeah, but leaving the coercion aside, if someone willingly wants to give
yes.
up an organ for money, which you think may be coming down the road pretty soon.
I think we're closer than I would have thought possible just 5 years ago.
I mean, if that person really has informed consent and will be able to save someone's life, and why shouldn't the person get something back? That's the question. Or that would solve the supply problem. When there is a real supply problem, why don't more people have a provision in their wills or on their driver's license that they will leave their organs?
Well, I think there's a lot of speculation about that. When I was doing the research for this book, I actually asked my son, who at the time was 16, I said, so, you know, he had his new driver's license. Did you sign your organ consent? He said, no, they wouldn't keep me alive. And I was really shocked because, I mean, that's sometimes given as the reason why certain groups in this country aren't willing to serve as organ donors. But I felt like he had a rather privileged existence. But the extent of the concern that doctors will not keep you alive because they see you as a potential organ source is very powerful and has certainly existed, you know, through the modern organ transplant era. I mean, coma is right there sort of at the beginning. And just to go back for a moment to your earlier point, though, selling obviously is not going to help us with the heart transplant part because you only have one heart.
But having people mention it in their wills or on their driver's license, that would help the heart transplant.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, and maybe we will do what the European Union has done, which is to have presumed consent so that people have to opt out. You know, we do have in this country, for example, presumed consent for corneas. So they don't have to, you know, when you die, they don't have to ask in some jurisdictions for permission to remove the cornea from the dead body. They just do it, and they, you know, those are supplied for people who need corneal transplants. But I think most people aren't aware that that's a potential issue.
I didn't know about presumed consent for corneas. I'm speaking with Susan Letter. She's the chair of the Medical History and Bioethics Department at the University of Wisconsin. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine, and you're listening to Progressive Radio. Well, presumed consent, I mean, if we see the outrage in the land right now over the so-called death panels, I mean, imagine what it would be if there was presumed consent. What do you make of this death panel controversy?
I find it oppressive in many, many ways. I guess, I mean, last week I was one of those people who watched the Barney Frank clip over and over again because I don't know what planet people are from who insist that there are death panels. I think having a conversation with somebody about an advance directive is very different than sentencing that person to death. You know, and Congress itself in 1991 passed the Patient Self-Determination Act, which made entry into the hospital an opportunity and an obligation for patients to, you know, to have the opportunity to express their wishes in case they were to, you know, go into end-stage disease or to be in a situation where they were being maintained by a machine, a respirator, or so on. It seems to me we want to encourage people to take the opportunity to express their wishes. I must have missed, you know, that provision in all this healthcare reform that said we were going to take that right away and that we were going to kill people or sentence them to death.
I mean, what goes on in hospitals a lot is without a living will or a advanced health directive is that the physicians and the nursing staff, they're required to go to extraordinary lengths.
That's right. That's right.
And these are some of the hardest issues for families to deal with if their loved one has not grappled with this before and you're just left in an impossible situation. Do you have any advice for families in those situations?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the one kind of advice I would give is that these are conversations that can be held, you know, not at the moment of emergency. And although they're hard and although they're, to some extent, they're theoretical and academic, at least you have some sense of, you know, what the values are of your loved ones in case you are put in that difficult situation or situations in which family members may differ over what mom would have wanted or what, you know, Uncle Sam would have wanted in this case. It's, you know, I think it's best to have the individual's expressed wishes. And again, you know, to have given some thought to what you might want in that particular situation.
My fear, not only about this controversy with the death panels, that it's going to sabotage healthcare reform or the possibility of real healthcare reform, but it's just going to set back this whole conversation about what to do with living wills, which seemed to make absolute sense to me. And so there are going to be more and more families and more doctors and nurses just, you know, in really impossible, the most emotionally draining situations that there are.
Well, it won't be the first time that we've seen sort of end-of-life issues terribly politicized and exploited. I mean,
you're talking about Terri Schiavo?
I am thinking exactly of Terri Schiavo. Here, we had been in this country reaching a consensus in terms of the courts and physicians, patient groups, about how to manage these difficult situations. And there, for short-term and gain and political extremism, you know, we had Congress, we had the governor of Florida, we had the president sort of intervening in these difficult situations, in my opinion, in an entirely inappropriate way that set back that conversation.
I mean, as a woman of science and a woman of learning, as chair of the Medical History and Bioethics Department at the University of Wisconsin, how frustrated do you get with know-nothingism?
Well, I don't think this is a radio interview is the appropriate place to express outrage. I actually had to turn off the television and radio last week because I found it very oppressive. I happened to be in Los Angeles, walking down the streets of Santa Monica, where, you know, there are people who had tables on the streets with Obama as Hitler in terms of healthcare reform, and I want to tear out my hair. I guess that's the nicest way of putting it, because I just find we had an opportunity to really advance the healthcare reform agenda in this country, an opportunity to redress the fact that 50 million, if that's the latest number of people, have no access to healthcare, you know, except through emergency departments or free clinics. And that seems to me to be an entirely unacceptable state of affairs. I hope I'm wrong. I hope that healthcare reform is still possible, but this hasn't been the best week in terms of optimism about it.
Susan Letter, what reform proposal do you favor? What solution do you favor to the problem of the uninsured and the other irrationalities of our system?
Well, mine is off the table, but it's a single-payer system. I think, all the horror stories that we've heard about Canada or Great Britain, they have a healthcare system that works a lot better than ours does in many respects, and one that people have access to. I think single payer is the way to go. It doesn't seem like it's going to be a politically palatable alternative. But I think, who would have thought Medicare would work so well just 40, some years ago? And yet it's worked so well that people think it's no longer part of the federal government.
That's what I mean just by, we're dealing with some people who are just so ideologically drunk or just so ignorant. Excuse me, but they are ignorant if they don't know that the government's paying for their Medicare.
I know. And when at first I couldn't believe that people were actually saying at some of these meetings, get your government out of my Medicare. It's a government program. Now, maybe there are reasons that people, keep these separate, but that kind of abysmal ignorance about the profound impact that Medicare had and the Great Society had on improving the health of a large segment of our population. Maybe we need to get that message out, the difference that it makes, the difference that Social Security made in the 1930s. They're not perfect systems, but they went a long way to improving the health and healthcare experience of a large segment of our population.
Susan Letter, you mentioned the Canadian health experience, and it is always dragged through the mud here by Republicans and conservatives, but a poll came out recently that said 85% of Canadians like their healthcare.
And they don't want healthcare in the United States, despite the kind of commercials that we've seen in advance of that. And I think, and I'm sure the Canadian healthcare system is not perfect. It has difficulties. But at least access for 50 million people isn't one of them, which is one of the huge problems in our, I also have little patience with the kind of incrementalism in our system that says, we'll insure children because they're valuable. We won't insure, young adults or people in middle age, but we'll insure old people. It doesn't make sense to me. I'm sorry. It just doesn't make sense.
Everyone is equally valuable and everyone should have equal coverage to health care, and Medicare for all is the most sensible solution. And I don't know why Obama didn't come out for that. Do you?
Well, I don't know, but I would imagine that there are important and politically powerful interests who oppose such a solution, whether it's insurance companies or, I don't know who else it would be. But
yeah, Medicare for all who want to join it anyway, that would be a compromise position, much better than the compromise positions
that are
offered
now. Yeah, I have to admit, I'm for single payer, but now even the public option has been withdrawn.
Doesn't look good.
No.
Susan Letter, I'm sorry to end on a sour note, but thanks for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Oh, thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.